Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with China's leader Xi Jinping's coronation of himself at the 19th Communist Party Congress, where he promised a new era of Chinese power, with his nation transforming itself into a mighty power that will lead the world politically, economically, militarily, and on environmental issues. And in drawing a contrast to Trump without mentioning his name, she noted that China has, quote, taken a driving seat in international cooperation to respond to climate change. Scott Kennedy, the director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of Global Governance in China, The Dragon's Learning Curve, joins us to discuss Xi's vision of a China he will lead, with him at the top of the Communist Party on top of China, and China on top of the world. Then we will speak with Lawrence Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration, who was in charge of manpower, to get an assessment of how the bitter and growing feud between Trump and families of the fallen is impacting morale and the important relationship between the men and women serving in the military and their families and dependents. We will discuss the apparently callous insensitivity of Trump, who, in consoling the widow on her way to meet the body of her dead husband, is alleged to have said that the slain Special Forces sergeant, quote, knew what he was signing up for, but I guess it hurts anyway. Then finally, we will speak with Jonathan Tessini, the author of The Essential Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America, who is president of the Economic Future Group and is a host of the Working Life podcast, whose new book, Resist and Rebel, The People's Uprising in America, will be out soon. He joins us to discuss his article at CNN, America Needs Higher Wages, Not Lower Taxes, and how increased unionization and a higher minimum wage, not lower taxes for the rich, will boost the American economy. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author of Business Lobbying in China and Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and his latest book is Global Governance and China, The Dragon's Learning Curve, and he has a new report at CSIS, The Fat Tech Dragon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Thank you.
And I don't imagine you watched the entire 3-hour, 23-minute address by Xi Jinping in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing at the 19th Communist Party Congress, where he basically, well, it was a coronation, but he actually crowned himself, I suppose a self-coronation, essentially saying or implying that he would reclaim China's historic greatness and that China needs a strong leader. And guess what? I'm your guy.
Yeah.
Is that
how? Well, certainly. You're right. It certainly was a long speech, and I think except for your diehard party members, and actually some students who were in China who watched it, it would have been, you know, basically torture for the rest of us. But I watched parts of it, and I've read all 22,000 Chinese characters of the report, and it's I think in not so many words he does pat himself and the Communist Party on the back, and points to China's successes under his leadership, and also sets forth a vision of where the party wants to take the country over the next 30 years.
And is this then doable? My understanding is when he talks about some of the problems like corruption, which I think is a pretty big problem, he said that corruption remains a greatest threat. But his 5-year war on graft, he says, has been built into a crushing tide, and that he warned that pleasure-seeking inaction and sloth were no longer acceptable. We must rid ourselves of any virus that erodes the party's health. Now, my understanding is that there's corruption, of course, but there's also, isn't there just a general disconnect between Beijing and the Communist Party cadres and leaders in the provinces, that the further away from Beijing you are, the less likely you are to follow Xi's orders? Is that somehow inherent in the structure of China?
I think as long as there's been a China, there has been a problem of the central authorities being able to govern this entire country, which is larger than the United States and has 1.4 billion people now. And certainly under Xi's predecessors, this challenge between center and localities became hugely problematic because of corruption and also just the incentives for local officials to focus on generating growth in their localities. But China, the party has also faced a problem of being at a greater distance from your average Chinese person and the rest of society. And, you know, Xi Jinping could have used a more liberal approach, rule of law, the media to crack down on corruption and other things to gain greater popular support. But he went in the other direction, and China has strengthened the Leninist hierarchy of the party from center to localities and over the whole population. And he's, of course, as you suggested at the very beginning, highlighted his personal role and this sort of this cult of personality, which we haven't seen since Mao.
So, in other words, he's more interested in discipline than in, certainly in freedom, doesn't it? That word was never used, personal freedom. Justice, no mention of either those notions, right?
Well, it is, you know, China's, I think Xi Jinping is trying to build a powerful, influential, wealthy China, but a liberal political system, civil society, a free market economy is not part of that vision. When he talks about law, rule by law quite a bit, but he's definitely thinking of it from the perspective of how does the party use laws to discipline its own bureaucrats and members of society. It's certainly quite, you know, China is not converging on the Western model either in politics or in economics. They have explicitly set out a third way they say is an alternative and a model potentially for others.
Well, but it has a slightly uncomfortable side to it, doesn't it? The way that they expunged the notions of democracy that we saw in Tiananmen that were crushed brutally was that they've ever since then they've encouraged nationalism amongst the young Chinese.
Absolutely.
And it seems to have worked, hasn't it?
Well, it largely has. Certainly there's plenty of Chinese who are unhappy with the tight controls on the political system, on freedom of speech, on the internet. You do have a dissident community. You have rights lawyers. But the most accept the system. Most have done better. Some have gotten really wealthy. And China's much stronger internationally. But it is a very illiberal system. It's not about freedom and liberty. China is pursuing a very different direction, which is certainly since the 80s, that's been clear under Xi Jinping. They are focused on a quite different form of governance that puts them at odds with what folks in the United States and democracy's favor. It's funny, though, that Xi Jinping says that Chinese-style democracy is better than Western democracy. So it makes you wonder what the definition of democracy is if it can be contorted to mean the exact opposite of what we think it to be.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author of China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization, Beyond the Middle Kingdom, and his latest book is Global Governance and China, The Dragon's Learning Curve, and he has a new report at CSIS, The Fat Tech Dragon. Well, just in terms of patriotism and nationalism, there's a lot of that in there. Of course, Xi promised that China by mid-century would have a first-class military in every way. A military is built to fight, he said. And then he talked about Hong Kong and Macau, the former colonies, and he said, yes, they can govern themselves, but only with patriots playing the principal role. And then the line that got the loudest applause at the Communist Party 19th Congress address by Xi Jinping, the 3-hour and 23-minute address, was when she said, "We will never allow anyone, any organization or any political party at any time or in any form to separate any part of Chinese territory from China." So those are the hardline parts of the talk, right?
Well, it's interesting that those lines gathered so much applause, but there was no substantial new ground in that part of the speech compared to what he's said before with regard to Hong Kong or even Taiwan. In both instances, this is almost boilerplate language, and there was no new red lines drawn with regard to Taiwan and what it's doing domestically. And so even though it sounds harsh, Chinese policy has been that way, but I don't think it raises any new red flags amongst folks either in Taiwan or in the United States about these issues. They're going to be big challenges, no easy solutions. But his speech didn't chart a new course that set a showdown for something in the near future.
Well, in terms of what strikes me as being positive in Xi Jinping's big, long, self-congratulatory speech was where he said that China is going to transform itself into a mighty force that could lead the world on political, economic, military, and environmental issues. And the only allusion to Donald Trump, who he didn't mention at all by name, but clearly implied that China had, quote, taken a driving seat in international cooperation to respond to climate change. Only by observing the laws of nature can mankind avoid costly blunders in its exploitation. Any harm we inflict on nature will eventually return to haunt us. This is a reality we have to face. Now, you know, I can only wish that an American leader would be saying that, but we have Donald Trump, Scott Pruitt, the Koch brothers, this whole mechanism in America to deny the very existence of climate change. And we're heading in the opposite direction, right?
Well, at least in our speeches, we are, and in Washington, it seems, perhaps. I think it's the Trump administration is doing China and Xi Jinping a lot of favors by a lot of our rhetoric and the potential steps we may take towards free trade agreements, the WTO and others, and on climate change, pulling out of Paris. That said, we shouldn't get carried away by suggesting that China is going to be the global dominant provider of public goods and a salvation for free trade and addressing climate change and other problems. China's, remember, its industrialization has been the most energy intensive, fossil fuel intensive of any, and it's now by far the world's largest emitter of carbon. And although it's investing tremendously in green technology and will be perhaps dominant in many areas of green technology, China itself still has a very, very long way to go. I think Xi Jinping recognizes this challenge, and certainly ever since he was the leader of a central Chinese province along the coast called Zhejiang, as he put a lot of attention on the environment and from water, because of water and air pollution. And so what we're going to need to do is hold China to its word to make its actions match its rhetoric. And maybe that will be an impetus for the United States as well. We can only hope.
Well, in terms of highlighting his trademark One Belt, One Road initiative, where they built roads, railways, and infrastructure projects, pipelines, etc., right across from China all the way to the Indian Ocean in Pakistan. And, you know, I've talked to geographers who've basically pointed out that this is a sort of an end run around the power of the U.S. Navy, the control of the so-called sea lanes of communication, like the Straits of Malacca, etc., which has always been the sort of mission of the U.S. Navy, that China has basically done an end run around that. And they've also made inroads into Burma, Myanmar, where U.S. diplomacy has sort of withered somewhat under Trump. And they'll be building pipelines from there as well. So is this to say that China actually does sort of look ahead, plan, etc., whereas where focus, you know, is on sort of quarterly earnings on Wall Street. Is that a fundamental problem here, or a difference?
I would say. I mean, I think the U.S. is going through a major transition within our domestic political system, and we are reevaluating our place in the world as well, all at the same time. These are interconnected with each other, and we're also, as part of that process, trying to understand how we're going to interact with the Chinese, what our roles should be, and obviously our domestic politics is making this a more complicated task than ever. I still think, by and large, the U.S. Views itself as an Asia-Pacific power that is not leaving Asia anytime soon, either on security or on trade. And, you know, the president's trip that he's going to be making to Asia in November, 11 days, five countries, two major summits, is going to reinforce that. Obviously, the Trump administration has said a lot of things that leave one scratching their head, but we're hoping that before too long, and hopefully through this trip, they'll enunciate a clearer strategy toward Asia that helps strengthen the U.S. role in the region, provide support, looks for areas of collaboration, also looks to limit the chances of conflict and aggressive actions by anyone else, including the Chinese. So I wouldn't count the U.S. out so quickly, even though there's certainly speeches or tweets that might point one to be worried about something like that.
Right, but you said earlier, Scott Kennedy, that in many ways Trump's been a gift to the Chinese, and it seems pretty clear that the TPP was designed by Obama as much as a strategic containment or a way to force China to play by collective rules as opposed to be the hegemon. And by abandoning the TPP, which is the first thing that Trump did when he became president, that is in effect a gift to China. Is that
sure? I would agree. But the U.S. position on TPP needs a little bit more context, because President Trump certainly did put the last nail in the coffin in terms of the current U.S. possibility of joining TPP. We also have to remember that his opponent, Hillary Clinton, ran in the primaries and then in the general election as an opponent of TPP as well. And she was one of the original crafters of the idea in 2010 when she was Secretary of State. And so that suggests within both political parties, there is a great deal of ambivalence about globalization, about the relationship between global trade investment and jobs and technology. And it's the U.S. Is going to need to go through this struggle of figuring out these rules. I would agree with you. I think TPP would have been extremely beneficial, not only to responding to the Chinese challenge and its industrial policy, but also setting new rules for all of us, especially in technologies and markets that the U.S. has a comparative advantage in. So the other 11 members of TPP look like they are going to go ahead and adopt it, implement it, and leave a seat at the table for the U.S. to come back to at some point. And I think the U.S. Will eventually need to take that opportunity for itself and for the rest of the region, too. And so, yes, I'm anxious. I'm also trying to be as hopeful as possible.
Well, just in closing, back to the comparisons that I mentioned a little while ago, the fact that the Chinese invested so much in infrastructure, and of course, as I mentioned, this goes all the way across Asia into the Indian Ocean. But within China itself, there's massive investments in infrastructure. Now, one of the things that we keep hearing here in Washington is that the one thing that would have been doable for Trump, since he hasn't achieved anything, would be an infrastructure package. It's never really emerged. Obviously, it's not a number one priority. I did speak recently with a former economist in both the Reagan and Bush senior administrations who was very critical of the fact that the U.S. was missing the boat in terms of investing in infrastructure and also dealing with global warming, which would involve massive infrastructure projects, building seawalls, etc. He thinks that's the answer to revive America's economy, that we basically need jobs, and this is the perfect way. But it goes against the grain, of course, with a lot of the free marketeers. But just as a student of China, do you think that we could learn something from what the Chinese have done in terms of infrastructure investments?
Well, I would agree that the U.S. needs to improve the domestic foundations of our growth over the long term, and certainly investing in infrastructure, hard infrastructure like railways, roads, airports, are important. The soft infrastructure, like a healthcare system that makes it so workers can change jobs easily, our education system, which gives greater opportunity to folks regardless of their economic station. Those are all critically important. The Chinese have done relatively well in those components of growth. The U.S. also has lots of advantages and that are still strengths that we need to encourage. We still have a highly innovative economy of venture capital and financial system, which helps nurture entrepreneurship and good ideas. And so there are some things the Chinese do that we might want to look at, but there's also things that the U.S. needs to recognize that we shouldn't give up. The U.S. does not need, for example, full-scale industrial policy like the Chinese. That's resulted in some big-ticket successes, but also very pricey and lots of debt and inefficiencies. So I think, looking for ways we might be able to improve things, but also recognizing the tremendous strengths the United States has is important as well.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good talking to you, Ann.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's a deputy director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Affairs. He's the author of China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization and Beyond the Middle Kingdom. And his latest book is Global Governance and China, The Dragon's Learning Curve. And his latest report at CSIS is The Fat Tech Dragon. We take a restation break. We're back looking into how the bitter and growing feud between Trump and the families of the fallen is impacting morale in the military and with military families. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration as the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Larry. And when you served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, you were in charge of manpower, which I imagine covers the whole idea of the morale of men and women in the U.S. Armed Services and the health, welfare, safety, etc., of their families. Was that a part of your portfolio?
Oh, very definitely. We used to say you recruit individuals, but you retain families.
So how does this whole insulting tweet war back and forth between President Trump and a Democratic congresswoman who was in the car with the family of the widow and the widow's parents on the way to pick up the body in Florida of the slain Green Beret soldier whose body was returned yesterday? As you know, a phone conversation took place. It was on the speakerphone in the limousine, and the congressman overheard it. And now Donald Trump is denying her version of it, even though the congresswoman's version of what was said was supported by the slain Green Beret's mother.
Yeah, I mean, that again, it's terrible because, you know, this is the second time he did this. You may remember right after he came in, several people got killed in Yemen. And what he said is, oh, Obama had planned that, mission, and it's really the military's fault. I mean, and then, you know, you do this where you're supposed to be reaching out to comfort these people to realize you have a young person whose whole life was in front of them lost. And while the person certainly volunteered and the family knew that, what you need to do is tell them how much what he did and the way they supported him means to this country.
Well, specifically, the congresswoman said Sergeant David Johnson is a hero. Donald Trump does not possess the character, empathy, or grace to be president of the United States. And then Donald Trump replied with a tweet, Democrat congressman totally fabricated what I said to the wife of a soldier who died in action, and I have proof, sad. When asked by a reporter what the proof is, Donald Trump said, let her, another is the congresswoman, make a statement again, then you will find out. Well, the congresswoman has, in fact, made a statement again, reiterating what she said earlier and offering up a second witness to stand by. As she said in response to Trump's denial, I stand by my account of the call with Donald Trump and was not the only one who heard and was dismayed by his insensitive remarks. And then Sergeant Johnson's mother told the Washington Post that President Trump did disrespect my son. In fact, she went on to say he disrespected my son and my family. So it seems as though Trump is somewhat trapped here. Do you think he's ever going to provide any proof, or is he going to double down as he always does?
I think he'll double down and say, well, it's the fake media, it's the Democrats. It's really unfortunate that you use, you know, these brave men and women as a political pawns. Okay, when he was asked why, you know, when he did it, he should have said, you know, I really should have, I'm thinking. But then lashing out at Obama, bragging in General Kelly's son, and both Obama and Bush people, George W. Bush's, you know, people said, no, that's not the way we handled it. I mean, Obama's wife had General Kelly and his wife to the White House to talk to them.
Well, the idea that apparently, according to the congressman, he more or less said more than once to the widow, well, you know, your husband signed up for it and, too bad. This is what happens. That is pretty extraordinary. Not that he just said it once, but said it twice. I guess.
Yeah. And again, you know, having served in the service and seeing, you know, brave people give their lives, that you can't say, well, you volunteered. What did you expect? No. I mean, you volunteer to protect this country, and the country will only send you into the missions that help our national security. And if you should get killed or wounded, we're going to take care of your family for the rest of, you know, their lives. That's what he should have said. You know, how can I help you? What about the VA? Have you talked to them? Have you, you know, seen about his, military retirement? Those are questions that he should have gotten into.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. So, of course, one of the traps is, and here you and I might well be falling into this trap, Larry, is to talk about Trump and his outrageous behavior and statements, and not about the reason for the original question from the press in the Rose Garden the other day, which is, what are we doing in Niger? So do you think that this is the politics of distraction?
Well, there's no doubt about that, that he tries to do that every chance that he gets. He did it with the NFL players and took away from, you know, the Iran deal. I mean, on Sunday, more people were, you know, focused on whether the NFL players took a knee rather than the fact that he decertified a nuclear deal and put the Middle East and Europe and us in jeopardy. Yeah, I mean, this, whatever else you may think about him, he's a smart politician. And, you know, I would venture to say he did not even know we had troops in Niger. I'll bet you he didn't even know that. He hasn't focused on it. I bet you he has no idea we have troops in 80 countries. He couldn't name them. And that's what I really do, you know, worry about. My grief for this family and the way they were treated, but I worry about the country when you have a president that doesn't seem to know what's going on. You know, he approved the attack on Syria at a dinner party. Well, it turned out, you know, we probably should have done it, but at a dinner party? And the same way he approved the mission in Yemen at a dinner party. No, these are serious things.
Well, it does seem that there's a couple of very, very scary trends underway in the Middle East, where the entire U.S. sort of military strategy is hanging by a thread, because we have basically relied on the Syrian Kurds in Syria as the boots on the ground, and the Iraqi Kurds in Iraq as the boots on the ground to roll back ISIS. And now, of course, they've been defeated in Mosul and just now in Raqqa in Syria. But this whole Kurdish independence vote was a very reckless thing to do. And I've talked to a number of experts on that part of the world who said basically this is a result that when you have a president who doesn't pay any attention to what's really happening and a State Department that simply doesn't have the personnel, doesn't have the assistant secretaries, etc., to deal with this, and that we have really got we're in a real pickle now because of the Iranians are basically running the show. And as you know, the Iraqi army took Kirkuk, seized the oil fields, which is essentially the economic viability for Iraqi Kurdistan. So, you know, you could have a major war there. Everybody's armed to the teeth. And Iraqi Kurdistan, again, these are the people that have been our boots on the ground. They're surrounded by enemies, Turkey, Iran, and now Baghdad. This is something that I would think, if you were back in the Pentagon, people had their hair on fire about this. But I get the impression that this is like an absentee landlord, Trump.
It is. And what, you know, the great irony, he's been claiming credit for Raqqa falling, says, see, my policy works. Okay. Basically, you know, Obama started it. But even if, you know, he helped it accelerate it by dropping some of the bombing restrictions, now what? What's your plan now? Okay. Are you going to let the Kurds control Raqqa? How are the Turks going to deal with that? What about the other parts of the country that are controlled by the Iranian, Russian, you know, Assad axis? How are you going to deal with that? What kind of government are you going to have? Those are the things, and that's why you need the diplomats there. Similarly, you know, I mean, if you had somebody over there in Iraq, they would have gone up to the Kurds and said, look, you know, we've been protecting you for a long time. Don't have this referendum, because if you do, you know, the consequences are not going to be good. And then finally, I mean, once we invaded Iraq, Iran's influence in that part of the world was going to increase. I mean, we should have thought of that before we went in, but that, you know, that's a whole other subject.
So what's your sense then of whether there's a way to let the American people, in particular the core supporters of Trump, who he's able to sort of manipulate with these, you know, this is sort of government by stunt, like as you mentioned earlier about the NFL kneeling issue, which is a phony issue. And is it possible that at some point or other, the people who think that Donald Trump is a patriot doing the right thing and standing tall and all of that stuff is in fact weakening America?
Well, I think where he's going to hurt his base is the way that he treated the fallen soldiers. Because even his base, who, you know, doesn't like a lot of American involvement and, you know, thinks our allies take advantage of us and all of this type of thing, they understand, because a lot of these young kids who are in the military come from the countries that are part of Trump's base. You don't get too many people, unfortunately, from, you know, the coastal, you know, join the military. So really, I think that is something that they're not going to be very, very happy about. The other thing is, I think, you know, you're right. Nobody asked the question, well, what are you doing in this year? Who are you fighting with? How did that happen? What would happen if we get drawn in more? Those are the questions I don't think his base, unfortunately, is worried about. And as I say, you know, he's claiming credit for Raqqa. That's where he's basically, see, I got Raqqa, I dropped the restrictions. Obama, you know, he wouldn't let them bomb, you know, any place that they wanted. I've done that, and look, we won. Great. Now what?
Well, first of all, you've got the Russian army or its military forces about two or three miles out of town, along with the Iranian Quds and Hezbollah and Assad's army. So they're poised very close to Raqqa, and I would have thought the real issue here is, since it looks as though the Russians and the Iranians and Assad are going to win this, if there's anything to win, that would be the issue, wouldn't it? Who pays for the reconstruction? Raqqa is a pile of rubble. If Assad and the Russians and the Iranians are victorious, then can we say, okay, you got it. You know, you want it, you own it.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing, because we destroyed most of Raqqa, the bombing we did. So our, you know, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, which are, you know, primarily Kurds, could take it. That's the question. Are we going to want to do that? Will Trump supporters say, oh, yeah, let's spend, you know, $5 billion over here rather than fixing up, you know, Pittsburgh or something?
So just to wrap up, though, on the widow and also on the congresswoman who was in the car, or the limo, I guess it was, on the way to the airport where the body of the fallen Green Beret sergeant was being returned, and the grieving widow, I've seen the picture of her slumped over the coffin. She already has two children. She's 6 months pregnant with a third, and obviously she's very distraught. The congresswoman said on a local NBC station down in Florida, how could you say that, talking about what Trump said, which is apparently said more than once, that basically, you know, your husband signed up for the military and he knew what he was getting into, so too bad. She said, how could you say that to a grieving widow? I couldn't believe it, and he said it more than once. I said, this man has no feeling for anyone. This is a young woman with a child who is grieving to her soul. And then on CNN, Congresswoman Wilson said, well, actually, rather than me reading what she said, why don't we just go to the clip from CNN where the congresswoman is questioned about the exchange in the limousine on the way to meet the body of the slain Special Forces sergeant, along with the widow and the widow's mother, who is also a witness. Let's actually hear the exchange between the CNN interviewer and Congresswoman Wilson.
I know this is the first time that you're hearing the president's tweet read to you, so when he says that you've totally fabricated what he said to the wife of the soldier and he has proof, what's your response?
Well, I don't know what kind of proof he could be talking about. I'm not the only person that was in the car. And I have proof, too. This man is a sick man. He's cold-hearted, and he feels no pity or sympathy for anyone. This is a grieving widow who is 6 months pregnant. This is a young woman. She's only 24 years old. She weighs maybe 110 pounds. And she has two other kids, 2 years old and 6 years old. And when she actually hung up the phone, she looked at me and said, he didn't even know his name. So now that's the worst part.
So Congressman, let's talk about that. What did you hear? Tell us about this phone call.
Well, I didn't hear the whole phone call, but I did hear him say, I'm sure he knew what he was signing up for, and but it still hurts.
So that's how you interpreted it. You interpreted it as the president saying something callous in that way. Obviously, it can be heard lots of different ways. It could be heard as the president trying to find some point of understanding to speak out to the widow. How did she hear it? What was her response?
She was crying. She broke down. And she said, he didn't even know his name. So
Did you hear the part where they left the impression that he didn't know his name?
She heard the part that he didn't know his name. And I don't think we should be trying to go into all of this. What the concern is, we have a soldier who died from Miami Gardens. And there are so many circumstances surrounding his death that I still have questions about.
I tend to think that the Congresswoman's report of what happened is accurate. It's been verified by the mother of the slain Special Forces Sergeant. And this is what we're dealing with here. Do you think Do you think that at the end of the day, I asked you the same question earlier about his base. How do you penetrate that bubble? But this is about the character or the lack thereof of the man who is the President of the United States.
Well, there's no doubt he has no feelings for anyone. That, you know, that's a given. But I do think the fact that he allowed himself to handle it this way is going to rile some of his base, because, as I say, his base is what sends a lot of these kids into the military, a lot of these families. And they're not going to be very, very happy at all. The military voted overwhelmingly for Trump, by the way. I remember seeing the statistics during the, you know, from Military Times and, you know, the polls and everything. They thought he was a strong, you know, tough leader and wouldn't be nuanced like, you know, Obama was. So I do think that this is going to hurt, because this is a step too far. I mean, it's one thing to get the NFL players, but somebody who volunteers to serve this country and gives up his life, and you don't respect that, that I think goes too far.
Well, Lawrence Cobb, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate you.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Cobb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how America needs higher wages, not lower taxes.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Tassini, who is the author of The Essential Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America. He's the president of the Economic Future Group and the host of the Working Life podcast, and his book, Resist and Rebel, The People's Uprising in America, will be published in the fall. And he has an article at CNN, America Needs Higher Wages, Not Lower Taxes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Tassini.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. And it's pretty extraordinary that the Trump tax plan working its way through the House and Senate has got as far as it has, in the sense that it is so flagrantly all weighted to satisfy the donors. But the challenge the Republicans have, Paul Ryan and McConnell and Trump, is to con their voters into believing that they're going to get a tax cut when they're not. The tax cuts are clearly going to the super rich. So the fact that it's gotten this far, I find it disturbing. And what do you think is the percentage of support for this fraudulent bill so far?
Well, I'll say specifically to the tax cuts, if you look at the estate tax and specifically the plan is to eliminate the estate tax, which only helps the Koch brothers, the Waltons, the extremely rich, because most people, individuals, have already an exemption of up to $5.5 million, you know, if that's what their estate is. So it's clearly just for rich people. I think that at least if you read the polls, the support is very low for this tax plan. That doesn't mean that the donor class and the Koch brothers and so on aren't going to buy that bill through. And my point in the piece that you cited And if people tweet at me at Jonathan Tessini, I'll send them the link to the article if they're interested, is that in some way both parties are complicit here. Certainly Republicans are the worst bunch of this, but Democrats, particularly conservative Democrats, because of the donor class, have a long history going back to Reagan of supporting these awful tax cuts. And my point in this piece, and I'll just make that quickly and let you probe on this, is that what we need in this country, if you're talking about economic growth, is higher wages, not tax cuts. And there is no evidence, zero, that tax cuts actually create economic growth, which I talk about and explore in the piece. The main problem we have in this country is that wages are too low, so people can't buy stuff, which if you don't have to be an economist to understand that.
Well, I want to get to what your piece is about, Jonathan. But I find it just so brazen that Donald Trump made his pitch for repealing the estate tax, as you mentioned, and of course, you have to have more than $11 million in your estate to pay any tax at all. So there aren't too many people that leave more than $11 million for a couple. And he made this pitch before a group of truck drivers, truckers, who they're not going to be subject to the estate tax, I guarantee you.
Well, this reminds me of, you know, that famous scene in Casablanca. I'm shocked that they would lie about this. I mean, that maybe I'm cynical or maybe I've been around in politics too long, but I'm not shocked at all by the brazen lying about this. And they're playing on people's fear. And that has been a Republican playbook for a long time, is scare the crap out of people that, you know, immigrants are the problem or that somebody else is the problem, that people of color are the problem, and then get people to support things that are actually against their own self-interest. So I'm not shocked by this complete hypocrisy, and especially with Donald Trump, who's a pathological liar.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Tessini, who is the author of The Essential Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America. He's the president of the Economic Future Group and the host of the Working Life podcast. His book, Resist and Rebel, The People's Uprising in America, will be published in the fall. And he has an article at CNN, America Needs Higher Wages, Not Lower Taxes. Well, let's talk about your piece at CNN, Jonathan Tessini, America Needs Higher Wages, Not Lower Taxes. My understanding, and I recently actually interviewed a former Republican tax specialist and economist who served in both the Reagan administration and the Treasury Department under George Bush Sr., Bruce Bartlett. And he was absolutely furious with what's going on with this fraudulent, you know, initially Mnuchin and Gary Cohen held up a two-page piece of paper as their original tax proposal, and then they've expanded it to 8 pages. And he basically said, you know, this is an outrage, and that what the country really needs is investment in infrastructure to get good-paying jobs, and that you could, for example, use the crisis of global warming as a way to start building seawalls. And I don't know whether you noticed the Chinese leader's speech today, but he made this case about the extraordinary infrastructure investments China's making both at home and abroad, dealing with environmental challenges, acknowledging global warming, saying that China will be the leader in the world in terms of combating global warming. Wouldn't that make sense to start talking about investing in infrastructure and creating jobs, or is that just too much an anathema to these free marketeers who think anything involving the government is socialism?
Well, I'm not against, obviously, infrastructure, and I think that's an incredibly important thing that everybody, if you just drive or you walk in on your daily trip to work, you can see how the country is literally falling apart. But to me, and what I focused on in the piece, is I think as a labor person about workers. And so I'm not, if you think about just creating jobs, if those aren't union jobs and they're not good paying jobs, the fact that you're rebuilding the country won't necessarily make a difference in people's paychecks. So I make two recommendations. We should immediately raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and immediately could mean in the next 2 or 3 years. And we have to have as a broad national policy unionization. The reason we are in this crisis that we're in terms of wages. And I want to point out 70% of our economy, whether we like it or not, is powered by consumer spending. That's just a reality. The reason we're in this crisis and have this weird economic growth that's very, very muddled, certainly over the last decade or two, is because of the decline in unions. Unions created the middle class. If you had a union job, you had a decent paycheck. And on top of that, when there were strong unions and there were high wages, that influenced non-union wages because, you know, if you were in a non-union wage plant, the employer felt obligated to raise those wages. So that's the crux of the problem. Everything else, infrastructure, climate change, I'm all for that. But we have to start with how do we get people's wages up and avoid this idiocy about tax cuts. We pay the lowest, almost one of the lowest tax rates globally in the entire, certainly in the entire industrial world. This country's tax burden, such as it is extremely low.
Well, of course, Donald Trump has gone on television repeatedly and said we're the most highly taxed country in the world. He kept repeating that at a press conference before his spokesman, Sarah Sanders. She repeated it. The press kept trying to say that is nonsense. And then she said, well, we have the highest corporate tax rate. And they said, but that's
not true.
But that's not what Trump said. So how do you get past the lies and get your point across? Do you have any heft behind you in terms of our political leadership, apart from Bernie Sanders?
Well, I will say that at least some of the Democratic Party is articulating the fact that it's not true that we pay the highest corporate tax rate in the world. I want to make this clear, when your listeners hear this and they have to argue this, when Donald Trump says we have the highest corporate tax rate, that's the statutory rate, 35%. That's one of the higher ones, but the effective tax rate, which is what matters, is quite low. And in fact, two-thirds of the Fortune 500 companies pay somewhere between 15% and zero. And many of the big ones, like General Electric, pay zero taxes. But it's all about us as movement people. While I'm involved in politics, and we have to force the politicians to do the right thing, it's really incumbent on us to build a movement to elect those people who are going to stand up for the people. And that's one of the reasons that many of us supported Bernie Sanders when he ran for president. If we don't build a movement behind whatever politician, we're never going to change this situation.
Well, I would say that this outrageous tax plan that Trump's putting forth, which is clearly designed to benefit the donors, and they're trying to con the voters into believing it's going to do some good. My understanding is that a working American will get about $60 back, and the middle class will get about $200, and the rich will get billions.
And that's why it's important not to focus on tax, because we have to change the conversation, which is what I try to do.
Right.
It's fine to rant and rave, and many people should do this, about the giveaway to the rich, but we've got to shift the conversation to say Democrats should also not be talking about tax cuts, which they often do. We should be focusing on raising wages.
Well, how do we do that, though? I mean, without government policy, how do you raise wages?
Well, that's what I say, that as a national policy, we should be arguing for national policy that says raise the $15, the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and have as a broad national policy, unionization. That's the key to raising wages. Now, none of this is going to be possible tomorrow because of the way politics is organized right now, certainly at the federal level. But that means that we have to organize a movement to have that conversation, and then elect people are going to implement that.
But in the meantime, what do we do about, for example, states like California that are successful states, relatively speaking, they're being punished getting rid of the federal deduction on state and local taxes. It is so cynically aimed at punishing successful blue states like New York and Illinois and particularly California that vote Democrat. So again, I keep getting back to the politics, but it feels to me like that's where the battle's being waged. And Trump is promising this pass-through deduction. Well, for God's sake, we've already had that example from the state of Kansas, where Brownback, the governor, brought through that so-called tax reform, allowing pass-through companies. And guess what? It bankrupted the state.
Although I suspect the state and local taxing is not going to survive because even some Republicans are opposed to it. So I'm going to bet that that doesn't make it to the final thing. But we certainly have to fight against this, you know, giveaway. It's just outrageous. And I agree with that. And, you know, I think that there's a broad movement to be built on that.
So where is...
And I only have 2 more minutes. I have to run. So if we could wrap up on this.
I'm going to get back to you. So getting back to, again, your article at CNN, Jonathan Tessini, the idea that we're having the wrong argument, we shouldn't be talking about taxes, we should be talking about higher wages. I don't think you'll find too many people who disagree with you because people are living paycheck to paycheck, and we're all hanging on by our fingernails. Where's your sense of where this national movement can start? And does it need a leader, or is this a bottom-up project?
But the answer is both. There is a bottom-up project already. I mean, people are campaigning for $15 an hour wages, and in fact, it's already the law in some states and cities, so we need to make that at the federal level, and then we have to argue for broad unionization. That's about a movement and also electing the right politicians to office.
And any suggestions in that regard? I mean, there is
I've already been behind.
Go ahead.
You know, the Bernie Sanders has been one person, and you know, there's certainly other people running for office who are worthy of support throughout the country, and people should connect with their local movements to figure that out. And it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I have to jump on another call. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, be good. Take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Tessini, who is the author of The Essential Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America. He's president of the Economic Future Group and the host of the Working Life podcast. His book, Resist and Rebel, The People's Uprising in America, will be published in the fall. And he has an article at CNN, America's Needs Higher Wages, Not Lower Taxes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.